KPFT Pacifica Houston, and we're having a little bit of trouble with our transmitter out there, but hope you stay tuned. With me right now is Ray Hill, whoever that is. In fact, they even put a picture in the paper of you, but didn't say a word about you, except for a short caption in the Chronicle.
They put such a bad picture on the front page the day before.
Oh, they were trying to make up for that.
They just put one gratis.
Okay. Right? Okay. Well, let's get down to this. I wanted to talk to you about this. You've been involved in the gay movement and in a civil rights movement for quite a while here in Houston. What is your feeling about the younger generation now? Are they as interested as the older generation were?
I don't think they experienced the frustration that my generation did. And when I say my generation, I don't mean the people that are as old as I am. The generation that I identified with is probably a decade younger than I am. It's the generation that came up in the 60s. I came up in the 50s. And the people that came up in the 60s had had all of that crew cut, slick back, high pant crap they could handle. Where men and women were shapeless in their clothes and issues were shapeless in the newspapers. And they were determined to find issues. We had problemized America into the McCarthy interpretation of what is real. And the generation of the 60s, as we refer to, rebelled against that and became very, very active at fixing the country. And did a good job.
And not necessarily just in the gay rights movement.
No,
in civil rights. And
gay rights is really a movement of the 70s. It's after the crest of the civil rights movement when we took care of basics like blacks and Hispanics and got those issues out and discussed it. And then there was the war, which gave us a lot of impetus for organizing. And somewhere in the process, somebody said, well, you know, there are other things we should be interested in. And then the women's movement and the gay movement began to emerge. It was a product of the time. And we, although we still think we've got a long way to go, somewhere in the 60s, we did accomplish a great deal. Gay people who are self-assured as gay people do not even have a concept of a whole gay world guilt-tripped, lying about what their names are, no one having close enough friends in the gay community to know where one another lived.
Well, this is still happening to some extent to some people.
Yeah, but relatively few people. It used to happen to all people.
All people.
I used to not know anyone's last name. And everyone I did know, I knew by nickname or some first name that wasn't legitimate. I spent 10 years learning the real names of people I had known for 10 years.
And you're talking about real names in radio. Many people don't use their real names.
That's right.
But yet, here at KPFT, all three of us, people associated with the show, do use their real names.
I don't know of anybody on KPFT that doesn't use their real name, unless they do it, you know, like Reverend Huey does it for effect. But everybody that is involved in media of change has to add the credibility of their real name.
Or their real name. Well, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk a little bit about the past is because we've got somebody running for mayor who has been mayor in the past. And is already starting to put advertising in the paper and the radio stations about what a good life the city has led underneath him, what all the wonderful things he has done. And there's an awful lot of people, including me, that's moved to this city after he was mayor and after he was out of office. And I don't know about that. Well, exactly how good was the administration of Mr. Welsh?
Well, in the last two terms, I've got to realize the last term he had opposition from a fellow by the name of Curtis Graves, and was one of the classic dirty politics races of all time, where Louis Welsh sabotaged the campaign. And Curtis was the first black man to run in a serious race for mayor, and nobody thought it was serious, but by Louis's last race, it was so bad. No, Fred run the last time. The time before that, Curtis Graves run. Curtis run in 71, and Fred Hoffman's run in 73. And in 71, Louis was on the wane, seriously on the wane, and he knew it. And so he spent the last two terms in office lining his pockets. I think that he, as mayor, would know where the development was going to happen before it was announced. He'd run up and buy property, and 90 days later, the newspaper headlines were full of it. Louis Welsh turns $400,000 profit on the land up around the airport. Herman Short was his real estate broker. Herman was the police chief at the time. And so the last 4 years of the Welch administration was strictly a line-your-pockets kind of thing. Louis had never really made any money. Mayors weren't paid well in those days, and he had never made any money in the auto parts business from whence he came. He went bankrupt in the auto parts business and finally wound up running for mayor. He ran for three times before he was actually elected. From what perspective? From the gay perspective, it was the grimmest possible times. I'd have to go down to the mayor's office on my hands and knees and slip in the back door and go up and visit then administrative aide Larry McCaskill, who would talk to me and talk to Larry about possibly lifting Herman Short's boot off gay people's neck. But it wasn't just rough on gay people. Black people had an impossible time under Louis Welch. There was one incident where a dormitory at Texas Southern University, there were 17,000 rounds of ammunition from police guns emptied in that dormitory with students in there. And when they finally stopped shooting, they went in, they dragged all the students out and stripped them naked, men and women alike, and laid them out on the ground. I remember those pictures in the newspaper. I was living in Third Ward at the time in an area where all of my neighbors were black. Matter of fact, across the street was a Black Panther headquarters. And Herman Short's surveillance was so complete that they knew that we were white people living in black neighborhoods and sent a squad car to pick us up, take us out of there. And we told them to get out of there because as long as they weren't there, we were perfectly safe in their neighborhoods. But as long as that squad car is parked in front of the house, I was not too sure how safe we were. They left and we stayed and I helped establish communication. All communication between white government and black people ceased to exist after the shootout at TSU.
So these are the good old times in Houston.
Oh, God, they were horrible.
That Mr. Welch wants to bring back.
Absolutely horrible. And that's exactly what Welch would try to bring back. But then, you know, Welch could bring about a revival of the 60s in the hearts and the minds of Houstonians of all persuasions. When your enemies to your freedom are such that you have to band together and fight, then you will band together and fight. Survival is really important, and the survival of freedom is as important as anything. You know, having been involved in civil rights movements and all of that, if you don't mind if I flash back to the case a little bit, because the case is a classic example of the 60s.
No, we were going to talk about that, but let's define what we're talking about exactly.
The case was there. Actually, it's my second case to remove a city ordinance from the books of Houston. The first one was an ordinance that said, I called it, was captioned, failure to identify as a witness, which meant that a police officer could walk to anybody on the street and demand proof of identification, and if that was not supplied, arrest them and take them to jail. In my case, I had a press pass pinned to the neckband of my T-shirt covering a trial in municipal court after a raid on Mary's, and I got up and walked out, and a cop followed me and demanded to see my driver's license, and I refused to show it to him. I said, this is all identification you need. And I don't have to document my identity in this country anyway. So I found myself in the basement of the court building, arrested for failure to identify as a witness to a trial, where the judge knew me and the prosecutor knew me and the defendants all knew me. And so they packed me off to jail, and I was in jail about an hour and 40 minutes. And then Judge Alfano had gone to lunch and heard over his radio that in his car that I had been arrested, and so he called the police station and ordered me into his court, and they let me out the front door, and I walked across into the judge's room, and he released me on my own recognizance.
What year was this, Ray?
1981, I think, is when I was
arrested. As recently as 1981?
Yeah. Kathy Whitmire was mayor because Fred Wilson was the judge in that court, and she appointed it. And, no, Fred Hoffines was mayor. This is prior to Kathy's first term. And in 1982, I won that suit. Actually interferes with a legitimate police function with criminal intent. There is a law that my case doesn't have any effect on that is still on the books. What my case affected was an ordinance that said by any word or utterance and other bizarre things. And I've been arrested four times under that particular statute, one time in the arcade of a bookstore, identifying undercover police agents. They couldn't charge him with a state law because the state law says that the identifying of undercover police agents, presence of undercover police agents, there shall be an affirmative defense if one's intention in doing that is to bring others into compliance with the law. And I can't think of what one's intentions would be otherwise. And the specific case, a friend of mine, Charles Hill, a young black man who was a frequenter of Laura Westheimer and had a young white female companion, were walking down the street, and when I first saw them, the officer was smirking at their being hand-in-hand, black man, white female, and so I thought I had that figured out. And as I continued to watch, Charles tried to help a truck get out of a parking space in a heavy traffic situation. It was Valentine's evening. There were a lot of people in Northwestheimer. It was Saturday. And he tried to help the truck get out in the traffic by stopping the traffic on the street. And the cop started yelling at him. And so Charles dutifully reported to the cop where he got his lecture. And as Charles started walking out, Charles has kind of a nervous condition, which started to leave. That twitch began to actuate because the officer had been rather rough on him verbally. The officer chased him down and dragged him back into the yard, and when the officer pulled, and I'm watching all of this, I didn't really get involved and didn't think to get involved until the officer drew back the flashlight, one of those big, heavy police flashlights, and was going to hit him, and I yelled, "For your own size," because Charles is not as big as the officer, and if you've got to pick on anybody at all, and so he turned around, classic line, "Are you interrupting me in the official action as a police officer?" And I said, "You got that straight, Jack." And so we let Charles go and come arrested me. I won that case. I have won all of those cases. But that made such good news media that an attorney friend of mine, Mike Manus, and I got together and looked over the possibility of challenging the Constitution. It's been 3 years ago, and it has just been successful. Some discussion as to what the city can do now. The city, of course, can appeal to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court considered a similar case from Illinois just 3 years ago. Hasn't changed composition. The vote was 6-3, so I'm not afraid to go to the Supreme Court. They can impanel an en banc panel for rehearing, but we've got more than enough votes there.